Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra played Carnegie Hall last Friday night in the Spring for Music Festival. They played three pieces, and a review in Third Coast Digest by Tom Strini, who's a fabulous reviewer, said, he went to the performance and to the after party. He wrote, "The musicians, without exception, were overjoyed at the way the orchestra played, marveled at the sonic pleasure of playing at Carnegie and the extra dimension it brought to them as players. The program showed Carnegie Hall and the Milwaukee Symphony in the best possible light. No other orchestra would come to town with this music, and very few orchestras could play it as well as the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra." We're delighted to have two key people with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra with us this hour to talk about playing Carnegie Hall, how they selected the music, what it is about the sound of Carnegie Hall that is so extraordinary, how you calm what nerves you must have if you're playing Carnegie Hall, how they were received, if those reviews are significant or if there are just too many of those reviews. We have two guests with us in our studios here in Milwaukee. Mary Ellen Gleason is Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra President and Executive Director. She was previously with the Phoenix Symphony, and she says that she loves doing concerts. We'll expect one of these in the future that engage the community in unexpected and surprising ways. She organized a concert to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Arizona Diamondbacks, and she commissioned a march of the Metro when the Phoenix area got a light rail system. She is a chamber musician, she's a violist, and her husband was principal trombonist for the Phoenix Symphony. Mary Ellen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Mark Niehaus is also with us. He is principal trumpet at the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra and has been since 2009. Recently completed a special recording project with an instrumental library, the Trumpet Collection. He spent three seasons as a member of the New World Symphony in Miami Beach. He began his professional career at the age of 18 while still a freshman at the Juilliard School. He assumed the post of principal trumpet at the New Haven Symphony, joined the faculty of the Juilliard School's pre-college division, and has spent many summers at all kinds of festivals, including Tanglewood Music Festival, the Eastern Music Festival, as principal trumpet of the faculty orchestra. So we're going to welcome phone calls. We're also going to hear parts of the three pieces that they played at Carnegie, and we'll do that during the course of this hour. And welcome phone calls at 800-486-8655, and take emails at talk@wpr.org. And read messages on Facebook on the Kathleen Dunn Show. Congratulations to both of you, and thank you so much. You must still be on a high after last week. And I guess the first question is, we'll give it to you, Mary Ellen. How do you get to Carnegie Hall?
Well, other than practice, which is our standard, most popular answer, it required quite a movement of logistics of people, a truck, 95 musicians. It was about 3 years in the works of planning the program.
Really? Wow.
The application. We had about 400 people from Milwaukee that traveled as fans, and we actually sold about 600 tickets ourselves to the performance. So we had a lot of different people participating in different ways.
You had 400 people travel from Milwaukee to New York.
Yes.
That's astounding, isn't it?
Yes, and we had special orange scarves at the performance, and to see them all, I don't know, I bet Mark had a reaction to seeing them from the stage.
Well, you actually asked earlier, you're going to ask about were we nervous, and you're not nervous when your friends are in the audience, and it was very obvious to us how many people had come from Milwaukee to support us because they passed out.
So
yeah, they passed out scarves, and honestly, initially when I heard about it, I thought it was going to be hokey, but it ended up being amazingly touching, and sort of seeing all of the people that came to hear. You know, I compare it to people following the Badgers and going to a bowl game and wearing their red uniforms. Mm. So it was quite amazing, and we felt very connected to our audience, our Milwaukee audience there in New York.
I heard that even some of the ushers were wearing the scarves.
They did. They all got into it.
Nice.
I have to imagine for them it's a lot of fun. You know, they go through the year at Carnegie Hall doing their regular concerts, and then they have this special Spring for Music Festival where every night of the week is an orchestra, a different North American orchestra that was selected. And I think it's a special time at Carnegie Hall for everybody.
So how do you get selected selected. You said it was 3 years in the planning. They came to you. Who came to you 3 years ago and said, we want you?
Well, the people behind the festival, a couple of very special people in the symphony industry. One gentleman is Tom Morris, and he's someone that's really known for his creativity and knowledge of not only classical music, but programming and that very special concert experience around our art form. And there were, I believe, about 50 orchestras that applied to be a part of this festival. And there's really two ways to go to Carnegie Hall as an orchestra. The first is you could rent the hall yourself and sell tickets and take a risk on the concert, which is pretty challenging to create a brand and have the kind of marketing wherewithal in New York City to sell enough tickets. And the other way, which is the optimal way, is you're paid to perform. And that's the way that we went this time, is that we received an appearance fee, if you will, for the performance. So it's very prestigious to be selected. And the selection criteria revolved around really two pieces: the quality of the ensemble, the quality of the orchestra. Certainly, Ado DeVart, our music director, was a key component of that quality. And the second piece was the innovation of the programming itself, the pieces that we presented. And as I understand it, this was the second year of the festival, Kathleen. And the first year, the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra proposed this exact program. And we were not selected for the first year, but we were encouraged to reapply. And so the second time, just as is, we performed that program.
And tell me what was on the program.
What is it, Mark?
Mark?
Well, it was three pieces of French Impressionist music, the third piece being, let's say, half French and half Chinese. The first piece was by Oliver Messiaen. It was called The Forgotten Offering. And the second piece we played was Debussy La Mer. And the third piece was Iris, revealed by a Chinese composer by the name of Chang. And the interesting connection between the pieces, besides them all being Impressionist, was that Chang was a student of Messiaen, who was in many ways a student of Debussy. All French composers are a student of Debussy.
Oh. So let's set this up for us. We're going to play a little bit of the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra playing The Forgotten Offerings.
Sounds good.
Well, that's all we need to say. All right. Well, let's hear it. Oh, my. Was that the beginning?
That's the middle.
That's the middle.
It starts off very quietly.
Oh, my.
And very meditative-like, and it ends very quietly, and there's this sort of outburst in the middle.
Oh. So, how long a piece of music is it?
I would say it took about 6 minutes.
6 minutes.
Yeah.
And what is it about? We keep reading about, but it'll be interesting to hear from your perspective and yours, Mary Ellen, the sound of Carnegie Hall. Is there something extraordinary about it? If so, why and what is it?
I think there's two extraordinary things about it. I think first there's the history. I think it's you walk out on a stage and you think to yourself all the things that have happened before in that exact space. And you end up feeling a sense of responsibility and you want to live up to what you know has happened before. And you also have a sense of responsibility to your audience that has come to hear you. So that's the first thing. So there's sort of a certain heightened sense of performance. The second thing is it's a very large space. The actual sort of volume of the room is very big, but yet you feel very intimate. I think it has to do with the shape of the stage behind you and the way it's sort of like a satellite dish, and it broadcasts all the sound back at you and also out into the hall. So we all noticed that we would hear things on stage during the pieces that we hadn't heard when we were in Milwaukee. I could hear the first violins in a certain way that I couldn't hear them when I was here. I could hear the percussion a different way. And what happens is all of the things you're so used to hearing a certain way shift and change, and then your perspective of how you fit in and what your role is changes. And you may play a little louder, you may play a little softer, you adjust because of the feedback you're getting. And the feedback you get in Carnegie Hall is massive. If that makes any sense.
Makes a lot of sense.
It's like you have extra ears. You hear a lot more. And from the perspective from the audience is they heard a lot of things that they hadn't heard before. You know, intricacies. You know, as the orchestra gets loud and becomes very strident, in many concert halls, the sounds will sort of mix together and become hard to distinguish. In Carnegie, it remains clear, even though it's at a high volume level. Mm-hmm. And when it gets soft, it still has sort of a strength to it. It doesn't just fade into nothingness. You could play very, very softly, and even the people in the very back row still feel like they're close to you and they can hear it. It's kind of like, I guess, the difference between yelling from far away or whispering up close. It's the same volume, but they have different levels of power.
What a great answer. Does it make you think that all halls need to be like that then? Are you spoiled now?
We're totally spoiled. I don't know that all halls need to be the same. I mean, every hall has its own personality. I mean, it's another instrument. It's as important as having a fantastic grand piano. It's as important as having a Stradivarius violin. Mm-hmm. The hall is like that. I mean, you could take the best orchestra in the world and put them in a terrible hall, and they're not going to really be that special.
Hmm.
But you can't take a bad orchestra and put it in a great hall and think that's going to work.
Right.
It doesn't.
Yeah. Mary Ellen, could you hear a different sound?
Oh, definitely a different sound and a richer palette, really, of sound. And the room itself is so elegant that the combination of the orchestra actually sitting on a wooden stage, so having the benefit of the sympathetic vibration not over the stage and the wooden instruments on the stage, and then the way Mark described the satellite dish kind of shape of the actual performance space, but the combination of the very, very thoughtful lighting of the orchestra, the gold trim, the ivory paint, the lovely seats, the whole combination. It's such an aural and visual kind of experience that it's for humans. They hear better when they see more, and so it was very successful to see our orchestra that we love so much in this, like a jewel in a different kind of a setting, idea.
I love this idea of having a sense of responsibility and thinking of what was on the stage before. I get that feeling whenever we all have our heroes. When I go to Springfield, Illinois, and I walk down the street and I think, Abraham Lincoln walked down this street. You know, I think about things like that all the time. And for a performer, I loved what you said, that you thought about who came before you.
Sure. I think
this is wonderful.
I think Tchaikovsky himself opened Carnegie Hall, did he not?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you think about, I mean, to have that kind of connection. And musicians in Europe feel that all the time, I think. They feel, you know, we play so much of this Western European music that they, you know, they see the name of the composers in the hall and they know they were there. And there aren't that many halls in the United States where you feel that, mm-hmm. that connection to the past.
Mm-hmm. So how do you prepare? Let's talk first about all of those trucks that went there. This was a lot of work to get everything coordinated. And all of the people who went, my goodness, all the performers, all of the instruments, all of the supporters. It was a major production, wasn't it?
It was, and there were even 10 students from the High School for the Arts in Milwaukee.
Oh, there were? Wonderful.
And we had a special kind of a social media section. They were blogging and Twittering and all that. And we actually had a radio broadcaster, Charlie Sykes, came along for the journey. Just a combination of people that just didn't want to miss the performance. Also alumni of universities from Wisconsin who were in New York attended. We had some fabulous donor events, parties, a tour of the Steinway factory. That was
Ooh.
Really exciting. Tour of Carnegie Hall. So everyone, I would say, had an experience that was very memorable, but also very comprehensive. Don't you think, Mark?
comprehensive, definitely. And for many of us, it was fun to go back to where we went to school. You know, many of our concertmaster, Frank Almond, our principal clarinet player, Todd Levy, and I all went to Juilliard.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of a homecoming of sorts.
Mm. Nice, except that it's nice to be from Milwaukee now, too.
It is wonderful to be from. We also all said as we came home to the airport and realized there was not as much traffic and you could walk from the terminal to baggage claim in about 3 minutes, that Milwaukee is a fantastic place to live.
And that you were a symphony that was invited to play
Absolutely.
Carnegie Hall.
That's right.
We were, and the we were the second to the last night of the festival, and the last night was the Nashville Symphony, and the reviewer in the New York Times really made a very special review of the concert, which was to combine the artistic footprint that Kenneth Schermerhorn started here when he was here in Milwaukee, when I believe the orchestra was only 9 years old, so in the late 60s, and then he went to the Nashville Symphony. And so it was a very interesting kind of connection between the impact that he made in creating, beginning this really excellent ensemble here in Milwaukee, and then going on to Nashville with a very different kind of their program was even, I would say, was really a spectacle. They did a work by Charles Ives that included 21 percussionists and 5 conductors. So they were really out there in terms of the forces and what kind of a concert experience they endeavored to produce. So, but anyway, but it was a very interesting tie between this one conductor and two different cities, very different orchestras. But
what about reviews? Do you read those reviews? Are they important to getting to Carnegie Hall and being invited again to establishing a national stature, or is it best to just ignore them?
Yes and yes and yes.
Okay.
I think all of that is true. I think that as a performer, you want people to like what you do. And I tend to read the reviews normally after someone has said something. Hey, did you see the review? And we have – I think we get reviewed in 3 different places on a regular basis here in Milwaukee, in the Journal Sentinel and the Shepherd Express and on Third Coast Digest. And I enjoy reading all 3 of them and wondering if those people went to the same concert, because mm-hmm. it can be very interesting to see how one person will be just completely moved and transported by what happened, and the other person will feel – and so you have to take it with a grain of salt in that sense. However, the New York Times review is a very important calling card, and the New York Times does not just give out great reviews to everybody. The ears that those people have are some of the most experienced ears in the business. They hear everything. They hear the Berlin Philharmonic. They hear the New York Philharmonic. They go to the Met. They're hearing the best of the best all the time. So to have someone from the Times sort of give their stamp of approval and say, you know, this orchestra sounds great, you know, it's not like your mom saying you sound great. It's someone who understands the totality of arts in the world and feels that you are in that stature, and that's the kind of review we got. And so in that sense, I'm proud of that. Do I put a lot of credence in reviews in general? Not as much, because I tend to try to please myself.
Yeah.
It sounds selfish, but
no,
that's kind of how it is.
Good. That's a good way to go about it. And your mom had to say that you sounded great, or you never would have gotten to Juilliard, right?
My mom would say I sounded great if I dropped my trumpet on the floor.
Aww. That's the way mom should be.
Well, definitely. But certainly the cachet, Kathleen, of having a positive review is impactful for the donor community, particularly corporate donors and foundations who are very interested in acknowledgement from kind of third-party sources to give them kind of confidence sometimes in making grants to the Milwaukee Symphony. So we're pleased that we had an outcome like that.
And the review focused on the program, the pieces we chose, but the review went out of his way to say how much each section of the orchestra sounded fantastic. So a lot of times reviews can end up being, I don't want to say like a book report, but sort of a synopsis of what happened, a reporting of what the piece and what the piece was about, and many times don't go into the quality of the execution of the program. In this case, he went out of his way to talk about how well executed it was.
Very nice. We welcome phone calls if you'd like to join our conversation, and we're going to hear excerpts from the other two compositions that were performed at Carnegie Hall. The Milwaukee Symphony played Carnegie Hall last Friday, and we're talking about their performance, how they got there, what it means to play Carnegie Hall, what it means for the financial future of the Milwaukee Symphony, what kind of production it was to get all the people, and 400 friends came. I just think that's one of the best stories of all of this, and it's all a good story, traveled to New York to support the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra. I hope at least one of you who was in that group and heard them happens to be listening to the radio this morning, because we would love to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, or you can go to our Facebook page too. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Even if you didn't see the performance at Carnegie Hall, many of you, I'm sure, have heard the symphony, and they are an extraordinarily wonderful symphony. They just keep getting better and better and are recognized as being very good by people all over the country. And that's well-deserved. So we'll be with you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I just wanted to tell you that the next time I'll be with you doing a show is Monday. It's All Things Political, the first hour of the program. Our guest from the University of Chicago, who will comment on national politics and also state politics. And then Anna Quinlan will join us the second hour. I haven't read her book yet, but she's just a real down-to-earth, smart woman who's been writing about so many issues for a long time. I still think she ought to return to the New York Times because her voice is needed. But she left a long time ago, and so she writes books now. And this is nonfiction. It's Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake, a memoir. She'll be with us Monday at 10. Two phone calls, 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Here's an email from Charlotte from Brookfield, who wanted to know about the local news coverage and was looking for reviews from the show at Carnegie. Do you know where we can find reviews, and what about local news coverage? Was it complete?
Well, we did have a review from Tom Strini in the Third Coast Digest. So that was our local review. And we had photographs in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Rick Walters from the Shepherd Express was also there.
Did he write?
And that review just came out, I believe, yesterday or the day before yesterday. And I think, as you find with the challenges that newspapers face these days, I think the Journal Sentinel chose not to send someone, however, had hired a photographer in New York, I believe, to take pictures. So yeah. you see a photographic record in the Journal Sentinel of what occurred, but not a critical review of the concert.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you can't say, but I can say there should be one. I mean, this is a fairly significant event, so it ought to be covered. It really should. That's all I have to say. It should be covered. We want to play a little bit more. We want to play something from each of the pieces. And this is, I'll have us listen to it, and then, Mark, if you would tell us what we have heard, okay? So this is one of the compositions, just about a minute of it, from Iris Unveiled. And this is the piece, I think, that received a whole lot of attention,
if I'm
right, didn't it?
It did.
All right, so let's listen. Some of Iris Unveiled by Xiang Chen. And this received just a lot of attention, I know, because of the instruments that were played, the Chinese elements in this, and how difficult this piece of music is for a symphony to play.
Sure. I think it's funny, someone just tuning in and listening to just that one little minute snippet would perhaps have confirmed in their mind their feelings about contemporary classical music being a little bit wild and crazy. And it's funny because that minute of music exists in about a 30-minute work, which is about the different sides of femininity. Iris being the god of all things feminine, and the piece reveals the different sort of the sultry sides and voluptuous sides and jealous sides of women. And that particular movement you just heard was hysterical. So that was the musical impression of a hysterical woman. And it's interesting because in the score, the piece calls for all the women in the orchestra to scream at the top of their lungs. Which is really quite, for everyone is a lot of fun, especially those of us who didn't have to scream and we're laughing. And it's, we all had to agree not to laugh because it ruins the moment for the audience. It's supposed to be hysterical and almost angry in a way. And at one point, there's two singers. At one point, the Chinese singer, screams at the top of her lungs, I am not your wife. And it's a very powerful moment, especially with the music that comes so much beautiful and sort of almost sultry music around it, to then have this outburst in the middle of the piece. So you cheated. You jumped right to the outburst.
I'm sorry. It's all right. It's good. I got a good explanation of what it was. Now tell me, there were some instruments that normally wouldn't be played, Chinese instruments.
No, the piece was a combination of the Western classical tradition and the Chinese classical tradition. Mm-hmm. There was an erhu and a pipa and a shang. And about 3 weeks ago, I never would have been able to tell you what any of those instruments were by name. One is what you would compare to, say, a hammer dulcimer. One you would compare to a vertical violin with two strings, and the other would be like a large guitar that you hold upright, and then along with one of the singers was an opera singer you would hear in the United States, and the other singer was from the Chinese opera, and which is very it's an incredibly unique sound, and it can be very disconcerting if you're not accustomed to hearing it. And Chen used it very effectively in the piece because, you know, you're just sort of swept into this French impressionist orchestral color that you're used to and you're accustomed to and feels comfortable, and then she comes in and starts singing in a way that just does not fit in, and it's very eerie. Mm-hmm. And very moving.
Mm-hmm. And Mary Ellen, tell me about the other components. Did you get to have to hire talent from China for this, or musicians? How did you get that element?
Well, indeed, we had to bring the vocalists actually from China for the performance, and the instrumentalists actually were in New York. Wu Man, who is the pipa artist, is a fairly well-known pipa soloist in the United States and does work with the Kronos Quartet as an example. So she's somewhat accustomed to being in the United States and concertizing. We did have a last-minute substitution for the erhu player, which is the upright violin that Mark was describing. And we were able to, I think Andy was from... just recently graduated from Juilliard, was known.
He played the viola.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's like that joke backstage. Anybody know an erhu player?
Really? I mean, didn't that cause panic? You don't have an erhu player?
No.
Oh, it was more, no. So we're accustomed to those kinds of things. That's a day in the life of a symphony orchestra. We hope that doesn't happen every day, but we know how to deal with that. And the zhang instrument, I'd mention it because The pipa, which is the upright kind of mandolin guitar kind of instrument, that's a relatively portable instrument. The erhu itself is kind of a diminutive little thing. But the zhang, which is this dulcimer kind of auto harp kind of instrument, is very, very long, maybe about 5 or 6 feet long. It was pretty big.
Yes.
And so these weren't instruments that we typically work with here in Milwaukee, but Ado DeVart, our music director, had performed this work in Hong Kong just a couple of weeks prior to this. And in part, this program was conceived because of his relationship with Chen. And in his role at the Hong Kong Philharmonic, he became exposed to really the best contemporary Chinese works that are going on now. So those instruments, along with all the other stuff, there were a lot of other traditional kind of percussion equipment we had to bring along as well. So a lot of moving pieces.
Mm-hmm. And what a nice challenge for the symphony to, I mean, you're really stretching yourself. You're doing something that you're not, as a musician, I'm sure, a very well-trained musician, really, really comfortable with. You are now, but it
you
took
mean,
some
you
work.
Mean, you mean
it?
Going on? You mean playing the Chinese music or going
yes,
on tour?
No, playing Chinese music.
You know, we play a fair amount of contemporary music in our orchestra, and we do such a wide range of different types of performances, from our Pops concerts. You know, we'll be playing Broadway music with Marvin Hamlisch one night. We'll be playing Beethoven the next night. This week, we're playing Mozart opera with the Florentine Opera. You know, and then so. It's actually an incredibly flexible bunch of people, and we have to be, because in order to serve our city and play all these different types of music, we have to be able to do all these things. And that was part of my audition here. When I auditioned for the orchestra,
really?
I had to play a Harry James solo from like a 1940s big band solo, because they wanted to make sure that kid could do that too.
That's great. Let's go to Randy in Hartford. Hi, Randy.
Hello. I just wanted to call and issue a compliment to the Milwaukee Symphony. I've been listening to the symphony for probably 30 years, and my standard for quality of symphonic playing is the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, which many think is the greatest in the world. And my wife and I travel down there to listen to the Chicago Symphony. And another thing that many people don't realize, in the 60s and 70s, Chicago Symphony came up to Milwaukee and played in New Line Hall 5 times a year, and that was on Monday nights, often with George Schulte. So we had quite a treat then, and I became familiar with that orchestra partly through that. But lately, under Ato DeVart, I think the gap in quality between the Chicago and the Milwaukee symphonies has shrunk to virtually nothing. As an example, one of my tests for quality of playing for a symphony is when I listen to a piece that I've heard many times before, and then when that symphony plays it, I hear it in a totally different way, or I hear things that I've never heard before. And the last Milwaukee symphony my wife and I were at was Tchaikovsky's Fourth. I think it was about a month or two ago, and when I listened to it, I've probably heard that symphony 20 times, either live or in recordings, and I heard it totally new. Heard phrasing in the orchestra, heard emphasis on certain instruments I had never heard before, and I just attribute that to the great quality of this orchestra. I think they're just at the top of their game. I wanted to give you that compliment.
Yeah, a wonderful compliment. Cool. And I've heard that from a lot of people, too, that the symphony is at the top of its game.
Well, I want to thank you for that. I'm going to have to agree with you. I know it sounds perhaps a little self-aggrandizing.
That's fine. That's okay.
And when you introduced me at the beginning, you said I've been in the orchestra since 2009. I actually came in 1998. That must have been
I'm sorry.
I'm about to finish my 14th season.
Oh, my goodness.
And I have seen this orchestra become something quite remarkable. You know, and it's interesting you talk about the Chicago Symphony coming to Milwaukee. You know, these great Midwestern cities like Chicago and Cleveland back at the turn of the century, well, the last two turn of the centuries ago now, about in like the 1900s, 1920s, decided they wanted to be great cities. And they didn't want to be seen as second class to New York and Boston and Philadelphia and places like that. And part of what their philanthropic communities did was say, we have to have a great symphony, or we have to have a great museum, we have to have a great symphony in order to be a great city. And Chicago and Cleveland especially, you think about it, Cleveland is not sort of regarded as cities-wise as sort of one of the larger great American cities. However, one could argue the Cleveland Orchestra is the best orchestra in the world too. So, but the community in Milwaukee has come behind this orchestra and has said, you know what, we want to have a great orchestra. And that's part of the reason we were able to attract a music director like Ato DeVart, who went from Minnesota Orchestra to the San Francisco Orchestra to Sydney to Hong Kong.
Ooh.
And now he's in Milwaukee. And, you know, that speaks a lot to what's happening.
And now tell me about the role of the conductor, because, you know, I've never played in a symphony. A lot of us have fantasies of being able to stand up there and conduct.
So but, do they.
That's funny. But what is it that makes somebody really superb at this? As you're sitting there and somebody's conducting you, how do you know that this person's really got the right stuff?
You know, it's kind of a, I want to use an example, but it's not appropriate. It's sort of like something, you don't know it until you see it, and then when you see it, you know that's what it is. It's, you know, the music director in American Symphony Orchestras is required to do so many things and have so many skills. They need to be a tremendous fundraiser. They need to be a tremendous manager of personnel. In many ways, they need to be a great speaker, an orator, to speak about their passion for the music. And then they have to be a fantastic musician. Mm-hmm. And then they also have to be a fantastic conductor. And those two things don't necessarily go together. There are many fantastic musicians who are not fantastic conductors. Mm-hmm. So with Ado, we hit on almost all of those. And part of it is he started out as an oboe player and playing in the Concertgebouw Orchestra in Amsterdam. And he understands what we need. He knows how, you know, it's kind of in many ways, I mean, you can think of these sort of very grand ideas of being a conductor, and they're standing up there just sort of emoting emotionally and be sort of, you know, some sort of modern dance to the music that enhances everyone's performance. And that actually can be not the best way to go. You can think of it as a glorified traffic cop. And sometimes you do have to get the orchestra across the street. You have to get us from A to B, and no one can get hit by the bus, and that's a skill. And when the orchestra trusts that this person is going to get us across this transition here from this place to this place, then they really start tuning in. And when you're really tuned in, then he can do subtle things to adjust speeds, to adjust volumes, to the way a phrase is tapered at the end. And then it comes down to, is someone able to show those things with their body? Because when you think about it, the conductor is the only person on the stage not making a sound. And that's why I always think it's never the conductor's fault, because he doesn't make any sound.
Right. How would you answer that? You're a musician as well, Mary Ellen. What makes a great conductor?
Well, it's really an extraordinary gift to find a person with the qualities that Mark described, and to have them really be servants of the art itself. And let's face it, when our orchestra is on the stage, they're performing the creative work of a person, you know, like a Beethoven or a Mozart, somebody else's work. And so there's a real a different responsibility there, as we talked about the responsibility of the orchestra being in Carnegie. There's a responsibility of the music director to interpret the music the way Mozart wanted that music to be heard and experienced by the audience. So they're very rare to find the kind of qualified conductors that can actually elevate those works of those composers in just the very right way. There are many, many conductors, but very few that can have the kind of experience that Ado creates here with our orchestra. And I'll say also further, the chemistry that's required, that it's a very finely tuned machine, that he's able, because of his personal connection with all of the musicians, to be able to bring out those subtleties, or I would never say surprise them, but certainly in a live concert environment, there are things that happen that are unexpected. And so he's a very, very gifted person.
Mm-hmm. He must be. We need to get him on, do an interview with him sometime. Yes. That would be interesting, wouldn't it? Yeah, after all this praise, I'd like to do that. Sean in Franklin, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, Sean, how are you?
Doing very good. I'm actually a student of a bunch of the players from Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra. I'm also in the Milwaukee Youth Symphony Orchestra as well, and I have done that side-by-side with Mark and a bunch of other players as well.
Great.
And for conductors, like what I've noticed throughout being like a Francesco conduct, Carter Simmons, Marjorie Deutsch, all the other people I've had, is I've noticed that they've been able to really get the meaning of the music to the players, not just saying like, oh, this is the rhythm, you know, you got to count it, subdivide it. No, you got to tune that. And, like, that's all the obvious things that they would tell you, but saying, like, this is what this composer was really trying to say here. This is what Beethoven meant. This is what Stravinsky wants here. He wants this, not this.
And they do that through words, Sean, or they do that through playing a piece of music themselves, or how they do that?
And it's a bunch of things there, because, you know, they'll stop me and say, guys, you're doing it wrong. Do it like this. Or the way they move, I don't know how they do it, but the way they move the music, which is with their arms, some way just affects you to play it differently. Like when the conductor gets all excited, all the players get all excited, and then when they're kind of sad and mopey, you do the same thing. It's really weird that they just change their movements just a little bit, and yet your whole entire playing experience is just altered.
Mark, one of your students, huh? Sean?
We have a wonderful relationship with MISO, the Milwaukee Youth Symphony. Every year we do a friend, Steve Richmond, sponsored a day where we sit side by side with them, and we go to the Youth Arts Center, their home, and it's funny because it's always, I teach a lot of the trumpet students in MISO anyway, so I'm basically hanging out with my guys anyway, it's a great time. And it's funny though, as you progress up the pyramid of your musical career, the conductor talks less and less. When you're in youth orchestra and in high school and then in college, there is a tremendous amount of information that needs to be imparted. You know, why is there a Turkish march in this Mozart overture? Why does the Beethoven Sixth Symphony end? Why does this movement end softly? Why, you know, these things that young people don't know. Ado assumes we know all this. And is honestly surprised if we don't. And it's my job to come to the first rehearsal playing in tune and playing in rhythm and playing all the notes right off the bat. So the discussions that we have tend to be more – they can be practical, but they can be ethereal. Mm-hmm. You know, why are we doing it this way? How are we – and a lot of times about pacing of the whole work. You know, we played a Bruckner symphony in one of our Carnegie preview concerts. We didn't take the Bruckner to New York, but the second half of our concert was a Bruckner symphony number 6. And it's like a marathon. And a lot of the discussion was, how are we going to get through this thing and build it the right way so that everyone goes on the journey together and feels satisfied when they get to the end, but not destroyed. Mm-hmm. And that's not really done with words. That's done with, wait, take it easy here. Okay, now let it go. Okay, now take it easy. Mm-hmm. Now, okay, we're going to do this.
Yeah. And it's also really extraordinary teachers are like that, aren't they? That it's not that they demand something of you, but you have so much respect for them that you tend to bring your best to the performance or to the rehearsal.
I think a great coach in sports does the same thing.
Right.
You know, the team believes in their leader, yes, and they feel many times that they have to win for this guy.
Right.
And that's but then the great coach is able to then turn it around and make it about the team.
Right. Yes.
And that's the difficult flip that it separates good from great.
Mhm. More phone calls in a moment if you would like to join our conversation. 800-486-8655. The Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra played Carnegie Hall last Friday, and we're talking about that experience and getting a better sense of why this symphony is so deservedly getting rave reviews from people all over the country. Mary Ellen Gleason is the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra president and executive director. She was previously with the symphony, Phoenix Symphony, and she plays viola as well. Her husband was principal trombonist for the Phoenix Symphony Orchestra. Mark Niehaus is principal trumpet at the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra and has been there since 1988. Is that right? 1998.
There you go. That's it.
I don't know why I'm having problems.
I didn't get the job when I graduated high school.
Actually, my little thing here said 1909, though, and I think I made it up. 1909, that can't be. He's recently completed a special recording project with the G. Shermer Instrumental Library, the Trumpet Collection, and has spent 3 seasons as a member of the New World Symphony in Miami Beach before coming to Milwaukee, and he's performed all over the country. So join us if you'd like, and we're also going to hear a little bit of the third composition that was played last Friday, and we'll have our guests set that up for us in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll ask Mark to set this up for us. This is a more familiar piece of music to most of us, Debussy and Lamer. Should we listen to something in specific? Specifically here, Mark?
We could. It's interesting how sometimes when people hear this piece, their response will be, well, it sounds like movie music. And what they fail to understand is it was written in 1905, and this is what all that movie music was based on. And it's visions of the sea. sort of the rolling waves and the spray of the air, and there's a storm, and it's incredible how if you just sort of close your eyes and get swept away, you can really feel the ocean. And when you think back to 1905, the sea was a mysterious place. There was no sonar or radar, and ships would get lost, and that was it. They're gone. No one knows what happened. There's no black box. So it has a very mysterious quality about it as well. So, and after we hear it, I'll recognize the spot, and
okay.
I can tell you what was going on.
Okay. Whoops, let me get your mic on there.
That was the last 30 seconds or so of the first movement, which was, I believe, titled From Dawn Till Noon at Sea. So that was the rising of the sun, essentially. Mm. And you could hear the light coming out. You could
sure
maybe
could.
Breaking through the clouds and being sort of splashed with sunlight while on the sea.
Mm.
I like that because I got to play loud.
Nice. Yeah, but it is fun to play the trumpet loudly. What's coming up? And where do we find out we're going to take another phone call, but what the season, what's ahead?
Well, we are playing the Florentine Opera this week, and we have a couple of terrific programs coming up, one featuring the work by Tchaikovsky, Swan Lake, a couple of special guest conductors. One is Miguel Harth Bedoya, who's a very interesting youngish conductor, as well as Matthias Pinscher. And we'll be completing the season with a Star Trek kind of a theme show, a space show featuring guest George Takei, who
nice.
I think everyone knows. He's not Mr. Sulu, is he?
It was Mr. Sulu on the very original Star Trek.
Right.
And then many of the, I think, like the first six or seven films as well.
Great.
So some fabulous and known personalities, but the projects that we're going to be playing on the classic series I think would be particularly meaningful too, especially since the orchestra is on a real high from the Carnegie experience. It'll be very, very worthwhile experiences.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and you should always be on a high from that. That's something one of those events in your life, I'm sure, that just, it's great to have had it. It will be in your memory forever.
I agree.
It'll be good. Margaret in Sister Bay. Hello, Margaret. Margaret, are you there? Oh, I'm going to talk to Margaret. That's my favorite name, too. Margaret?
Hello?
Oh, there you go. Hi, Margaret.
Oh.
Yeah, we're here. Go ahead.
Okay. My husband and I have been 20... This will be our 20th season attending the Milwaukee Symphony. We lived in Chicago area and came up every year until we have transitioned to Sister Bay. And this last year, I have noticed that, you change the positioning of the varying sections of the orchestra, and the sound is so much more wonderful than it's been. And I just wanted to thank you for that.
Well,
thank
sure.
you, Margaret.
That was, part of that whole experience came from completely accidental. The shell, the wooden shell that surrounds the stage, sort of the acoustic shell that we use, fell in the hall, and as they were moving it around, one of the motors broke. No one was on stage, and no one was hurt. It was when they were transitioning between a Broadway week to a symphony week, and so we were without the shell, and we ended up playing a few concerts without it, and we realized, wait, this sounds different, and we like this. And maybe there are some things we could do here to improve our experience on this stage.
That's amazing.
So we actually set aside a day where we rehearsed, not for a concert, but we rehearsed and we tried, I think, like 8 or 9 different setups. So we'd play for 15 minutes and then we'd all get up and walk off and then they'd move everybody over here and let's try this. And we tinkered and experimented. And with the idea primarily of getting as much of our sound to go out into the audience. So if you notice, we've moved the double basses now, instead of sort of being on the side facing towards the middle of the orchestra, they're in towards the middle of the orchestra facing out. And the violas are now over next to the first violin, so they project out as well. And the cellos have been positioned more towards the middle, so they're facing forward as well. And we've moved the French horns around behind the woodwinds, so their sound is bouncing directly off of the back wall out. So it's much more of an engaging sound for the audience.
What a backstory. Thank you both so much for being with us. It was a lovely hour. I really enjoyed it. I hope you'll return. Thanks.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thanks for having us.
Great fun. Our thanks to Mary Ellen Gleason, who is the executive director of the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra. Mark Niehaus is principal trumpet. Thanks for your calls, everybody. And remember, there's more to come with the symphony, of course. And I want to thank Brett Jespers for producing the hour and Rhonda Fanning for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for listening. Be with you again on Monday. Great conversations ahead. Stay with us.